Thank you for joining me. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, March the 11th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me. Let's kick off the show. So there's been a thought that has been swirling in my head over the last, not that long, 25 minutes or so. But if you've ever heard Jesse the Body Ventura talk, he has a very, very pronounced way of speaking. And as you know, I'm a big wrestling mark, pro wrestling mark, and which is pro wrestling code for super fan. But there was this documentary that came out in 2005, and it was about the WrestleMania event that took place in Seattle, which I went to because I live in Seattle, and it was my first one ever. And the introduction, and I was trying to find it on YouTube, and I cannot find it. I have it on DVD, but just an enormous amount of work to try and pull that in and get the audio for it here. But basically, the opening to the documentary sounds, it was something like this. It was like, Seattle, Washington was the home for WrestleMania, and just like every place it goes, WrestleMania fever had taken over the town. And that's kind of how I feel with coronavirus right now. So coronavirus has taken over the town. Seattle is in a completely different state right now. It's really wild. My day job is entirely out in the field, working with customers, going into offices, shaking a lot of hands, doing all that kind of thing. And repeatedly, I'm being told by customers that they are not letting any outside people come into the office. And the coronavirus is a real thing out here, and I'll get a little bit more into it here in a couple seconds. But I wanted to make sure I thank the patrons of the show. So patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast is a place for creators. So if you have a favorite podcast, a favorite internet radio show, a favorite musician, this is a great way to support them if they're on Patreon. So throw a few bucks in the tip jar. It's something that's recurring. You sort of set it and forget it, never have to think about it again. But it ultimately helps get this, keep this on the air for free. There's a lot of things that I do in my life, and ultimately, this podcast, in one way or another, despite me loving it, still takes me away from doing other things or other endeavors that I could be doing. And so I love bringing this to you. I'm 115 or something episodes in. 120 have been recorded already. So let me give a big shout out. I'm going to start from the most, the furthest back, which is all the way back on November 15th, 2018. So a lot of support. So big shout out to Kim, and then Barb and Arnie and Helen and Sarah and Kristen, Stan, Adrian, Sarah, Brian, Alyssa, Casey, Julie, Caroline, Ross, Holly, Christina, Sean, Jenny, Eddie, Jennifer, Anthony, Chad, Victoria, and Serena, the most recent one. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for supporting the podcast, helping keep the lights on, helps pay for equipment, helps pay for publishing fees, helps pay for the time that goes into it. So thank you again from the bottom of my heart. And if you don't feel like putting a couple bucks in the tip jar, you can always go and leave an iTunes review on Apple Podcasts. You can also just like the Facebook page, write a recommendation on Facebook. There's a whole bunch of ways that you can get involved. with that being said, I can't remember if I said this on the last episode or not, but I recorded another episode recently with a therapist who I, with Dr. Dan Ratner. We did a part 2 and 3, actually, and he provided a really awesome TMS manifesto for people that basically his whole idea on it is that if you don't feel like you can afford therapy or you can't go to a therapist for whatever reason, this is a great sort of DIY. And I uploaded that and provided as a gift to the people in my Mind and Fitness Podcast, the Leaders of Pain group on Facebook. So if you want to get free access to that, that is the place to go and get it. So like I said, coronavirus fever, pun intended, has swept the entire area of Seattle. In fact, I think the United States deaths at this point are somewhere around 30 or so. 23 of those are about 15 miles from my house in a retirement facility, which is just terrible over there. But ultimately, companies are telling workers to work from home. My customers don't want to see me. Here I am. I'm just sort of busting my butt trying to get, I guess, the next couple of months set up and hoping that this story dies down and you know goes away for a little bit. So today's podcast is awesome. I got so much feedback the last time that I had Liz Wallenstein on the show, and she graciously decided to join me again. We did a little bit of Q&A from people, from listeners of the podcast, but a lot of the time was spent really like addressing the elephant in the room from the previous podcast we had done, which was a lot of how do I do this? And so Liz went into great depth, and that's a lot of what we spent our time on. You know, normally when I record a podcast with a therapist or even just with a Joe Schmo, we spend an enormous amount of time on the story behind their pain. Since we did this in Liz's previous episode, which you can go back and find it, I think it was episode 100, this episode is entirely on methods and techniques and things that you can do. So really wonderful episode. And it didn't get mentioned in the podcast, but I wanted to make sure that I let everybody know that Liz is on Facebook. She is on Instagram. She is on LinkedIn, and she's also on YouTube. So she's got a lot of different places of content that you can find her. So feel free to search. She has a lot of really wonderful praise, and I think that she is lovely. So without further ado, here we go with Liz Wallenstein, part two. Now, a couple months back, I had a guest on the show, a therapist, that got a lot of I got a lot of positive messages about it, and there was a lot of positive comments about it, and I even got some follow-up questions that the guest for today's podcast was so graciously willing to record. So LizWallensteinTherapy.com, from LizWallensteinTherapy.com, is Liz Wallenstein, who's back on the show after, 12-week-ish hiatus. Liz, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me again. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Thanks for spending some more time here. And there was a couple different directions that we're going to take the show, and I think we're going to Tarantino it and go opposite of kind of maybe what the original plan was. It was going to be like a Q&A, but then something sparked in you where you kind of wanted to maybe change the trajectory and messaging of the show. Tell us, you know, what you're thinking would be the best use of the time for listeners, and ultimately, how did you arrive there?
Okay, sure. So I saw some of the questions that were coming in, and generally just seeing some of the posts in the group, and like the thought that was coming up for me is like, they're missing something. You know, what are these people missing? What will help them to really get it? Because I know, you know, one of the things that you asked me before we got onto the call was, you know, some people say the therapists come on and they talk about the why, but what about the how? And I was saying that I think we all know the how. Like, the how is pretty straightforward, and like, you know, work on conditioning, you know, work on believing that there's nothing physically wrong with you and this is emotional. And then, you know, if it helps to journal to get those feelings out, or it helps them, you know, like all those things are the how to get better. But the question is, well, if I'm doing that and I'm not getting better, why? And then that brings me to like what I want to talk about with you guys today is like, trying to help you deepen your understanding of this. And I usually find in my therapy work, like that's what helps it to finally click in so that what you're doing like makes a difference.
Yes. So we got to dive deep into that. And then we're going to follow up at the very end with maybe some questions, direct questions that came from that thread. But yeah, and one of the things that we're going to get addressed in some more detail, and something that has come up recently a couple times from people who have emailed me, have said there's a lot of talk on the podcast about why does this happen? Why do I get pain? Why does it persist? Why does it not go away? Why doesn't anybody around me seem to have this? Which I would debate that. But how does it happen kind of thing. So I think maybe some of the things that you're going to chat about today, we'll be able to derive some of those answers off of that. And I would imagine you agree.
And one of the other reactions that I get, you know, hearing and reading, you know, people's reactions is people are actually trying too hard. Like they're thinking too much. So I'm hoping, not that what I'm going to say today is so simple, but I am kind of hoping that it's going to simplify the process for people, like to stop the overthinking and just kind of give you some basic stuff to plug into and say like, okay, you know, maybe this is what's been missing all along.
Well, let's start there. That's a great place to start, actually, is there's somebody listening to this that is wondering what you mean by thinking about it too much. Can you elaborate?
Just to give you an example that comes to mind for me, like I don't use any of the terms, you know, like I see constant use of terms, you know, symptom imperative or extinction burst or, you know, like, and the reason, and I'm not anti that, you know, if somebody wants to, they can, but the reason why I personally don't is because, like, I feel like it's really making it into a thing and it's making it, you know, even more complicated and this thing that needs to get, like, figured out. And I think that TMS patients and, you know, different people call it different things. I usually say TMS, but it's also PPD or mind body syndrome or however people call it. But, you know, TMS is Sarno's term, but I think that they tend to, you know, do more than they just kind of be. And so I think a lot of the work, say in therapy that I do with people is helping them to just be. It's like you do what you need to do, but how do you build trust in the process? How do you let it kind of just unfold? How do you just ride out that wave, you know, to get to where you need to be? I think there's a lot of that needed, and like TMSers are not so good at that. They're always like five steps ahead of themselves.
So TMS. TMS, right?
Right, right. So this is kind of like just slowing down, trusting the process, and just kind of, you did your part, now let it just kind of unfold.
So let me tell you what I think you're alluding to there. So here's an example.
Okay.
One of these TMS groups that I'm in, I think that you're in them too, but somebody may come on and they may say, help, help, help. I had back pain forever. That went away. And now my knee has been bothering me for the last 3 weeks. What do I do? Somebody comments to them. This is just the symptom imperative. But then that person then goes on Google. They Google symptom imperative. They find a book that mentions it. They go and they read the book and they kind of get sucked into that same hole. Is that kind of what you mean in that example?
Yes. But even more simpler than that is like if you just said to the person, like, keep doing what you're doing, you'll get it. You know, like, I mean, assuming that that person is doing something, but I'm saying like, to put it another way is I feel like people try to control it. You know, this also comes up for people who have tendency towards control. And it's like when you give up control, that's when you see the magic happen. So like, I would say instead of worrying, like there's a lot of worry behind that question. There's even a lot of worry in the response. Instead of worrying about it, like, try to come to this calm place of I'm doing the readings. If you're journaling or if you're, you know, working your conditioning, and I'll talk more about those pieces soon. But then just kind of just let it run its course. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't worry about having every little bit of information and mastering it. And I guess what I say about the terms is I think it makes people think like, oh, I got to know what that is, and I got to master it, and I got to, you know, like. Instead of just like you have the information, it's just kind of keep plugging away at that.
What would you say to somebody that's listening to this right now and is yelling at their, you know, I almost said iPod, how out of date, iPhone, whatever, and right. They're saying, but Liz, my back is killing me.
Right. So if you want, we could kind of move into some of my, advice that I kind of have for people today, that I think will speak to that. And again, you know, again, I'm going to give practical tips, but again, it's just about kind of like, how do we simplify that process?
Yeah. And one of the things also that I would like you to touch on, at some point is, you had mentioned assuming that they're doing the work, maybe a couple of examples of some things that they can do or should do. Cause there's probably a lot of people listening to this too, that, have just read a book or they haven't done anything and they just kind of have an interest in this stuff and they're hurting.
Gotcha.
So a couple of practical applications that are easy enough to do.
Yeah. I can do that.
Awesome.
I see recovery as having two parts. Do you want to get into that? Because I think the first part will definitely give you some really practical tips. And then the second part is more the emotional psychological stuff. It's kind of a little bit more theory. It might give you a little bit of a psych lesson, but that's also meant for people to be able to kind of plug themselves in and see, you know, where's the work for me? Does that sound good?
Liz, I took 50 credits of psychology in college, and it's my one regret from when I went to school that I didn't keep going with it.
Really?
Because I thought it was fascinating. I got a minor in it. And right. it would have been pretty cool instead of trying to get into sports radio, which I didn't end up doing anyway. So I am all good with a psych lesson, and especially about this stuff. And I bet that everybody listening would be too. Right. So start there. Let's go.
And I think doing this show, you know, becoming like a Frasier of sorts, and you can like be an honorary, therapist. So.
Was that a Frasier the TV show reference?
Yes, you know that he was a radio. But was that in Seattle?
I was deliberately about to say, you know where that takes right. place, don't you? Yeah, right in my town.
Right, that's funny. Right, right. But he was that like radio therapist or whatever.
Yep.
So not so foreign. But so I started out by saying that, you know, I see recovery as happening in two stages, one having to do with the head and one having to do with the heart. And I see a mistake that people make is they do one and not the other. So that's why I want to kind of touch on both today. And I would say also that the head should come before the heart. That's kind of like building the foundation for the heart work. So to tell you more about the head, and I think this is going to answer some of the questions you were just asking me, I see this as building a foundation, and I don't want to rip off anybody else's work as my own. So I'm going to say that this next part that I'm going to tell you about actually comes from Alan Gordon, who's a, you know, TMS therapist out in LA. He was, you know, he had told me about this a bunch of years back, and I've been using it as part of my practice ever since, and it's very helpful. So he was trying to study what was the difference between people who had a book cure and people who didn't. And he found that it came down to fear. And that's why, if you know his stuff, he and Dr. Schubner are a lot about fear for that reason. I'm going to build a little bit more on that. And in addition to fear, I'll say like trust, that people who read the book and kind of said like, oh, yeah, I got this, like, now I should be fine. And they kind of trusted that they'll be okay. They weren't worried about there being problems. They just expected to be all right. Those are kind of the people that had the book cure. And the people who read it and said, well, this makes sense. And, you know, I think this might be me. But what about this and what about that? And I don't know about this. And, you know, who had fears and difficulty kind of trusting the process are the ones who usually did not have the book cure. And something that I find constantly also is that, like, I don't come across that many people who say, like, oh, this stuff is garbage. You know, it's definitely not true. But I do come across a lot of people who say, oh, I totally believe it. It makes sense. I think this stuff is credible. But what if I'm the exception to the rule? Like, what if my situation isn't that? So that kind of creates that loophole that could prevent somebody from having that book cure. So then the question is, well, then how do you develop that trust? How do you get rid of that cure? And this is where also, you know, Alan Gordon kind of talked about getting confident in the diagnosis. So how do you get confident in the diagnosis? You know, I saw something recently, All the Rage, you know, that documentary about Sorno and the mind-body, you know, connection. Yep. So I follow them on Facebook, and he had posted like a few weeks ago that when he went to go interview Sarno, for his documentary, and he said to his secretary or something like, oh, you know, I hate to bother him. He's probably so busy. And the secretary said to him, actually he's not, like, he's got, availability and what's his name? Is it, Michael?
Galinsky. Yeah. Michael Galinsky.
Yeah. Right. Michael Galinsky. And he was shocked. And when I read that, I was shocked as well. And I mean, I know that Dr. Sarno was very big on, you may not even read, you may not even need me, just read the book. Or if you come see him once, he'll say, you may not have to come back. Like, he's good like that, that he's not trying to turn into a business. But the fact that, you know, but like Michael Galinsky was saying, that there's probably this assumption, oh, he's so busy, he's so inaccessible, that people don't even try. And so it was shocking to know that he had this like availability. And so obviously he's not with us anymore. He's not available. But, you know, I think that people don't utilize the TMS clinicians enough. And I'm telling you also from somebody who's, you know, networked in other therapy fields and networked with other doctors for other things. And like, the TMS community has to be extremely accessible. They're very nice. They make themselves available and take advantage of it. So I definitely find the people that I'm working with, people tend to get better faster or have more full recovery if they've seen a TMS doctor. And even more so if they stay connected to that TMS doctor, like go back if they need to. But it helps people to be confident in diagnosis if they know that, okay, I've seen the TMS doctor and they've seen my situation, they've checked me out, and this is what they had to say about it. And obviously there's not one in every state, but it's worth even traveling if you need to. Or a lot of these doctors will get on the phone or Skype or something for a consultation, even if you're not in their state. It might be an investment of time. There might be an investment of money. But like, again, if you really believe that this is what you have and this is what will help you, then that investment is like, you know, paybacks, you know, tenfold. It's definitely worth an investment making. So that's one way of getting confident, is like, go see a TMS doctor, develop a relationship with a TMS doctor, or even something like, let's say your issue is stomach issues. And there's Dr. Clark, who's a gastroenterologist, you know, like, reach out to him, you know, see if you can talk to him. Like, that's one of the best ways, I think, to get confidence in diagnosis. And you know, if you see one doctor and you didn't love that visit, go see another one if you can. Like, I think that's one great way. And some of the more, you know, accessible ways is read another book. You read Sarno's book, try Schubiner's book, or Hanscom's book, or any Clark, or, you know, whoever. Something that helps people is to look up their specific symptoms, especially if they're rare symptoms, let's say on the TMS wiki, hear from other people who had it, read success stories or listen to success stories really helps people. And one of the things that I like a lot with my clients is what Dr. Sarno talked about, the evidence sheet. If you're able to write down all the evidence that is TMS. Like, so for example, because it doesn't hurt consistently, like if it was an injury, it would consistently hurt every time I step on it or whatever it is, the things that don't make sense or times where you've had this emotional release and then it went away, things like that would all belong on an evidence sheet. Write those things down, and anytime you have doubts, look over that evidence sheet.
It's interesting you say that. I got sent a manuscript 2 or 3 days ago by somebody who's writing a book on TMS, and they wanted me to read it first. And I'm like 20% of the way in, and the section I'm at right now is about making an evidence sheet. That's exactly as you described. One thing I want to add too, because I thought you were going there and then didn't quite go there, but you were talking about basically the different symptoms that would be associated with it. One thing that Alan Gordon says in one of the videos in he's got the 21-day recovery program.
Right.
One of the days, I can't remember which one it is, but he's talking, it's one of the videos, but he's talking to somebody, and what he's getting at is that basically the more symptoms that you have, the more likely that this is, you know, mind, body, PPD or whatever, because he's trying to have a very logical conversation with them, even though you can sort of see their fear about it. But he's like, okay, so you've had neck issues and wrist and stomach problems and migraines. What are the odds that there are four different isolated issues that have occurred versus this being a global systemic thing? And they were sort of getting it, and I'm sure that at some future session they got it. But I wanted to make sure I added that in as you said it.
Yeah. No, that's a good example. And then another thing, and maybe this will be new to your listeners, but I find really works well with my clients, is to redefine success. So, you know, TMS sufferers often have very rigid thinking, very black and white. And so, you know, and it makes sense that people would say, okay, success is to be symptom free. And obviously, you know, that is the end goal. That's what you want. And it should be possible. But I tell people, like, you have to start before that point. So, like, I know for me, what I love about the TMS diagnosis is, like, I never have to be somebody with just a bad back or this, like, you know, like you talk to people all the time and they're like, oh, well, I have this problem or I have that, or I can't do the things because this is, you know, bad for me. And being a TMS patient means, like, even if you have back pain, you don't have a bad back,
right?
You know, so there's a certain comfort in that you're a healthy, able person who, you know, even if you're not right now, you can live normally. Or, you know, going back to that All the Rage documentary, something that really stood out to me in it was, you know, when Michael Glinsky went to go speak to him on his last day of work. And he said, you know, all I wanted people to know is that the mind and body are connected. And just the simplicity of that, that like, it's not, obviously you want to get better, but it's not about like, oh, are you better or not? It's just like knowing that, you know, there's a connection between the mind and the body. And so you can cure the body by going through the mind. But again, like kind of practical application for people. I say for success, instead of, am I symptom free? Ask yourself, how did I respond to my pain? So like when you feel your pain or something gets triggered, if you respond by saying like, oh no, here we go. Like, how long is this going to last? How bad is it going to be? You know, how long am I going to be out for? You want to stop yourself. So when you go on that oh no path, it makes it worse. Instead, you want to try to get yourself to like a very calm and confident place of like, I know what this is. I know what I have to do. A kind of a meditation that I tell people to have in their head is, I have everything that I need. I have everything that I need. You know, I'm okay. Because if you can get to, again, you know, that fear issue, if you can get to a place of not having fear around the symptoms, that makes it go away much sooner. Another thing I tell people is, I don't say positive thinking, because I think you got to do something that you can realistically do, and it's too hard to be positive when you're, you know, having those kind of symptoms. But I do say neutral thinking. Like, if you can create space for the possibility that you can get better right away. Like, don't be tied to outcomes. Like, don't, you know, like, just say, you know, well, maybe I'll be better in 5 minutes from now. Like, I don't know if I'll be in pain all day. Like, who knows? Let's just wait and see. Like, let's just wait and see what happens. Like, that neutral kind of thinking can also, you know, create some of that calmness that helps people feel better. And I also like to say, like, having a sense of humor. Like instead of saying like, oh crap, you know, here's that pain or whatever, if you can like laugh it off and say like, you know, here it is again. Oh, you know, like it just doesn't give up. Like, you know, not having anger, but kind of trying to laugh it off, because again, the idea is you're not scared of it.
How would you, I mean, at that point, cause this is making me think of, I think it was Sarno, could have been Galinsky, but it was in that movie where basically and Howard Stern also, I think the quote was, this is going to be like Inception. I think the quote was from Howard Stern, and it appeared right in All the Rage, but he had said that basically his body has become a barometer for what's going on inside of him. So when you talk about like, oh, here comes this back pain again, and are you going to, you know, are you going to find it humorous? Are you going to go down the fear path? Whatever. Is that the indication that, okay, I've got pain now, this is the internal barometer, I need to stop now and journal for 20 minutes, right? Like, if you feel overwhelmed with life as it is, which may, you know, that may be why you're sort of getting symptoms, like, should people be stopping and then going and actively doing something, or no?
So if you're asking me, I say, you can say to yourself, do I want to journal right now? Will it help me? Because adding pressure on yourself or forcing yourself to do stuff, I feel like contributes to the pain. So I never make anyone do anything. I always say, like, if you think it'll help you, if you, you know, want to see if it'll make you feel better, then you can do that. But I think that giving into that rigid thinking of, I must do this now, you know, this is the good or right thing to do, that kind of is what got you there in the first place. And we don't want to strengthen that kind of thinking,
because that's the trap sometimes that I've had in the past, and even sometimes get guilty of, where you know, sometimes like life just gets heavy, right? And then I start feeling it I have a particular spot, and I think most people probably have a particular spot if they start filling up their emotional barometer, and it's like you know, two kids in gymnastics class and my regular day job and the podcast and like all these things that I have to do. And then it gets to be, you know, and I get up at 5:30 in the morning and I go to the gym, and that's, I really, really love that. But by 9:30, if I'm like 9:30 in the evening, if I'm thinking like, shit, I still have to like I still got to write this journal if I want this back pain to go away. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll sit down here and I'll do it for 20 minutes or whatever. But then it's 9:50 and then I go to bed at 10 and then I finally fall asleep by 10:30. And now it's only been 6 hours of sleep or whatever. I feel like sometimes that's becomes a sort of a vicious cycle in itself.
Right. So, you know, I'm sure there's people who disagree with me, but since you're asking me, I would say that, you know, in that situation, it might be more helpful or more healing for you to say, you know what, I don't have to journal right now if I don't want to. What if I just trust that I'm okay and that, yes, I have stress, but my body can handle it. And, you know, I have an idea of what those stressors are, but, you know, I'm okay.
Now, I know that society in general is very, we're a very, Nicole Sachs, I love this phrase she has, that we're a take a pill society.
Right.
If you, you know, pretend that you're the goddess of everything chronic pain and TMS, if you had 100 people in front of you that unequivocally you knew that they had TMS, what is the magic wand wave to them that unequivocally will get, that gets people over the hump? Is it, which again, this, it's tough to be prescriptive in this nature, but to, is it the getting over the fear that is the single biggest thing? Is it just knowing that you're absolutely okay and there's not a physical problem with you? Is that the biggest thing? Like what is the biggest thing, or maybe two things that have to happen in order for people to get well?
Right. So, for me, I think that the not having the fear and having trust, like what I was saying earlier, kind of letting things unfold. Like everything is exactly as it needs to be. I have everything that I need. Like the deeper you can internalize that and come to a place of peace, the less you'll need the symptoms. So, you know, when I was saying there's two parts to the recovery, what I was just talking about right now was like the head part of recovery, like how to come to a place of peace, hopefully within your head, you know, so that you can kind of have that calmness and let go of that need to be in control, or let go of that putting pressure on yourself. And if you want, we can switch to, you know, what I think is the second part, you know, how to get to that place in your heart, you know, looking at the psychological, emotional. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So to summarize the part about the head, there's actually a friend of mine, or a former colleague of mine, her sister has a band that's actually a pretty well-known band called The Head and the Heart. I think that's what it's called.
Oh, really?
Which is interesting name. I don't know if it's about any of this stuff, but
right.
So to summarize, the head part is really like being able to intellectually grasp that there's this thing is TMS or PPD or whatever it is, and that it occurs because of this. Like basically it's grasping the concept, being able to explain in an elevator what is it.
But I would emphasize getting confident in the diagnosis.
Okay.
Meaning if you have any doubt that that this is what you have, or any doubt that you could get better following this model, you need to get rid of that doubt. That's really how I would summarize the head part. And that's why I was giving examples of what, you know, what could hopefully eliminate that doubt for you, because the doubt is what creates fear. So you're eliminating the doubt, you're eliminating the fear. So whether that's, you know, doing some of those examples like the evidence sheet, or getting confident by speaking to a TMS doctor directly, or having that phone consultation, or that redefining success, that, you know, instead of saying, I wasn't successful because I still have my symptoms. Success is, how did I respond to my symptoms? If I responded by getting myself to a calm place, or being, you know, a neutral stance to it, instead of going down that road of fear and letting that fear snowball, then I was successful today. And I would say, like, do that check-in at least once a day and ask yourself, was I successful today? And the answer is yes. If you didn't go down that fear path and you tried to neutralize it, and just kind of be open and trust the process, and you were not successful if it snowballed and you got wrapped up in the fear and you got to keep trying to get to that place. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And as you're saying that, I hopped onto the PPDassociation.org website, and the entire splash page, like the front page of it, it's a variety of videos. There's Alan Gordon on here, Eric Sherman, Arlene Feinblatt, but it seems like the overall, just by not clicking on any of these videos, that they're all very fear-based. In fact, Eric Sherman's video is literally called Dr. Eric Sherman Discusses the Role of Fear.
Oh, wow.
So it sounds consistent with what you're talking about.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's even coming from the psychoanalysts, you know, Dr. Sherman's a psychoanalyst. So, like, you know, these are the people really immersed in psychology that are saying that. So, yeah, that's a common thread.
What before we jump into the heart part, because it's making me think that I think a big barrier of entry into getting the head part of it, the being able to go see a doctor, as an example. I know you had said that there could be expense involved, there could be a time allocation involved. I've seen a lot of people that will post and say, I've spent estimated $20,000 on trying to fix this from the physical realm. I just can't stomach the notion of flying to Detroit and waiting 6 months to get an appointment with Dr. Schubiner and all the costs that would be incurred with that. And I completely get it.
Yes, of course.
And so you're saying like the evidence sheet is one thing. And see, for me, like as an example, even though because like the PPDA website has a whole directory of doctors, right? So you can find them in different parts of the country. But the doctor that I had that sort of turned me into this world. She didn't know who Dr. Sarna was, didn't mention to us. All that she had said was after looking at positive imaging tests and all that kind of stuff and seeing like every other doctor that looked at it said, you have a problem and that problem is this. And because it was imaging and stuff, she had said, I don't really care what these tests say. Like basically it's been around long enough and the pain you're describing is to such a degree that what's your stress level like? And have you thought about like this being a psychological issue?
Well, good for her.
So when you've worked with patients over the years, or I guess we'd call them more clients over the years in your world, I mean, how often do you tend to find that where they go into a doctor that's not like a TMS specialist doctor that even makes an implication that this could be psychologically rude? Is it not common at all, or is it starting to get more common, or I guess what commentary would you have?
I would say it's starting to get more common, but something in between is probably getting more in common, like a holistic view. So they're still not putting it entirely on stress or emotions, but you know, they're more open to like something not being physically wrong, but that's also why we're getting so many of these autoimmune and things like that, because they were looking for other things to blame it on. But I think that what I was seeing a lot was, well, people will come to me and they didn't go to a TMS doctor, necessarily. I mean, I was working in New York mostly, so people were able to, but a lot of them hadn't. But they would say, you know, but I went to these doctors and everybody's giving me different answers, or they're telling me that they can't find anything wrong. And so that's how I know it's TMS. And like, you could do that. That is one way. But I saw such a difference when somebody would speak to a TMS doctor and like, here's somebody who knows what it is, knows how to tell if you have it or not, you know, and it just gave them so much more certainty, you know, and that certainty was so helpful in their recovery. Like, okay, somebody who knows what this is and knows how to identify it told me that I have it.
Right.
And but if you have a doctor like your own who doesn't identify with the TMS world, but was able to say, hey, you know, this isn't making sense physically, and I think you need to be in touch with your stress, then great. But I just don't think there is a lot of that. I think doctors are trained to pin it to something physical. And so whatever looks like it's most likely, they tell you that.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Certainly. Okay. I think we got the head part grasp. Big step two is getting to the heart.
Right. And I want to say also, like what I was saying before, people usually do one or the other. So the head stuff I was just telling you, I see as the foundation. And some people, they skip to the emotional stuff, I think, too soon without getting that confidence in the diagnosis and without neutralizing that fear. And that could be something that's stopping them from having a full recovery or making it take longer.
Yep.
And then I see the other way around also, that some people pay so much attention to like, breaking the conditioning or something, but they don't do enough in terms of the heart. And like a common mistake I think that people make is they think, okay, what are my stressors? But a lot of the times, like the obvious stuff, like the stuff you know that's going on in your life, is not usually what it is, especially if the pain is very bad and very persistent. It's usually more subconscious. It's kind of like a threat. And so that's why it's, you know, it could be harder to get to on your own sometimes. But you want to go a little bit deeper. So that's where some people aren't doing the psychological work adequately, is they're not getting deep enough.
So let's get in, because I imagine that that's the good segue into the second part.
Right. So I want, you know, saying you get a little psych lesson today. So I wanted to talk a little bit about attachment theory. It's usually used to understand like relationship dynamics, but I think of it constantly when I'm working with TMS patients. So psychologist and researcher John Bowlby like identified four different attachment styles that start in infancy and then stay with you into adulthood. And one is so the four types are secure, and then there's anxious, preoccupied, avoidant, and disorganized. And basically, so Mary Ainsworth, who was another researcher, she did a test with infants, and I'll just tell you like quickly what that study was because it was pretty interesting. They put a baby in a room with their mom and a stranger, like playing with a toy. The mom walks out, the mom walks back in, and then both the mom and the stranger come out and come back in, and they see how the baby responds. And there was four different types of responses, basically. One was that the baby would go to the mom for reassurance when the mom came back in, but then they'd be quickly reassured and they go about playing and they were fine. And that's what they call secure attachment. Then there was a baby who had more of an anxious response. They go to their mom for reassurance, they go back to play, but they keep looking back somewhat like anxiously, like, are you there? Are you still there? Like, what's going on? And they call that anxious or preoccupied attachment. And then there was like a baby who doesn't show any visible response. Like when they use their tools, they see that the baby's actually having a physiological response inside, but it won't show the response. It kind of just goes blank. And that was called avoidant attachment. And then disorganized attachment, sometimes called anxious avoidant attachment, had features of both the anxious type and the avoidant type. So the secure attachment, which was the first one that I talked about, those babies grow into adults that kind of just trust that things will work out. The world is basically fair. They're powerful. They have influence over their lives. So those are the people I typically don't see, meaning those are the people who typically don't get TMS in a major way. You know, everybody has, you know, their body responds to stress and everything, but the like big cases are usually not people who would have a secure attachment. It's usually people who in the three other groups, or, you know, that are all considered insecure attachments.
One thing I would ask as we go through these four categories, because there's not any babies listening to this. So the four different categories, you gave great examples of when like in action or the way that they would act in this particular controlled situation as babies. What would, you know, maybe a sentence or two of likely what this person is like as an adult that falls into each category? That would be probably super helpful.
Yeah. So that's what I'm going to go into now.
Okay.
So let me just say one thing with the secures was that, how, you know, when they study this, how do secures become secures? It's because their parents were very in tune with them. The parents got them. They got what they needed. They responded accurately most of the time. And that helped the baby develop into feeling like their own person. But now to go into the other three types, because that's more where you see the TMS cases. So for anxious, preoccupied people, how it looks like as adults, is there a preoccupation with like, am I okay? They get stuck in their heads. They get very in tune with how others respond to them and they're affected by it. Like they're constantly looking at others or outside of themselves to know, like, how am I doing? Am I okay? Am I acceptable? And the parenting style that they predominantly had was an inconsistent response from their parents. So sometimes their parents got their needs, sometimes they didn't. Maybe they were in tune with some needs and not others. So the child would get anxious because they're not sure, like, what's it going to be this time? And so that anxiety kind of goes with them into adulthood. For the avoidant attachment, the way they look as adults is kind of disconnected, numb, aloof. They kind of have this mentality of, well, I don't need them anyway, like identify as being, you know, very independent or a loner. And the avoidant attachment usually comes from parents who are missing it, like, or resent the needs of the child. Like there's a lack of congruency between parent and child. So the baby develops kind of like an, I don't need you reaction because, it feels rejected or feels like its needs don't matter. And then the disorganized attachment is kind of a combination of the anxious avoidant. That usually happens when there's abuse because the baby feels a biological drive to go to the parent for comfort and help, but it's conflicting with a fear of the parent because of past experiences where, you know, they were yelled at or they were hurt or they were made to feel scared in some way. And so that conflict causes kind of a freeze response. I find like very severe cases of TMS usually fall in this case because it's like they're frozen and they don't know what to do with the stimuli rushing at them because it's hard to know how to get kind of comfortable. And those people tend to freeze or their senses can get overwhelmed. They may have flashbacks. Their thought processes can feel very choppy, kind of incoherent. Like that's how it would look as an adult. So now I can talk about like, you know, so why does this matter for TMS recovery? But any questions on that? Is that clear?
Well, I know the third one was the avoidance. Is that what it was called?
The last one I just did?
The third one, the one right before the last one.
Yeah, avoidant.
Because that is like me to a T. In fact, while you were saying that, I was thinking about, let me preface this by saying that my parents are great grandparents. Yes. They were great parents to me. But I could remember distinctly, I would get out of school, middle school or elementary school, I would get out at, you know, 3 or whatever, and middle school 2:20 and then high school 1:50. But I would get home and then my mom, who's a teacher, she would come home at 3:15 and 3:20. And whatever it was that I wanted to bring up, hey, watch this episode of Home Improvement with me, which is funny because my daughter watches that with me now. Or hey, I want to talk about this, or hey, whatever. And the answer was always, I just got home from work. I need 10 minutes. That doesn't matter. And so
exactly.
And so all throughout high school, I remember just sort of having this attitude. And then as an adult that like, hey, I don't care what people think about me. I'm a loner. I don't need people. I'm all good.
Exactly.
In this.
Right.
And it kind of led to a lot of like career choices where I would say like, work remotely, but work entirely like an inside type of a job where I would never be out with people because I'm like, I don't need anybody. You know, I'm not relying on anybody. And then it's not necessarily true at all.
Right. Oh, no, of course. It's never true. Right. It's a defense mechanism, yeah. You know, because of the experiences. Yeah. And by the way, most of the parents of the clients I work with are not like horrible, blatantly bad parents. Every parent makes mistakes. A lot of parents are doing the best that they can or the best they know how. They don't realize the ways they're impacting their kids negatively, but every parent has some kind of negative impact on their kids.
I mean, like, and this is the extra shitty thing, yeah. Is like, the, you know, I try and I feel like so often as like a parent, like parents, like a parent myself, that like I'm trying to do, okay, whatever it was that my parents or parent did or said or acted like or whatever, I can't do that, right? So then you kind of go 180 degrees and you try and go completely opposite way. But there are definitely times where I'm like, I'll say something to Zoe where I'm like, like that's mom. That's right. Like that's what
right,
my,
exactly.
my, and I like said I wouldn't do that kind of yeah. thing.
Right.
Interesting because you brought it up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And what happens when you read this stuff or you learn about this stuff, you get very nervous about, you know, well, how are my kids reacting? And what am I doing to my kids?
Right.
But this research actually shows that like, you only have to get it right like 40% of the time for your kid to have like healthy development, which is very reassuring because that's less than half. But
it's like a D plus. That's like a D plus. Or actually, it's right. not even a D plus. It's an F. You just get an F basically.
Right. Well, but it's basically about attunement. Like if your child has a general sense that you are attuned to them, like that you get them, you see them. If they feel like you respond to their needs for the most part, like, you know, you get what they need, then they should have, you know, that secure development. But when there's interferences and sometimes it happens like because the parent, you know, it's circumstantial, the parent is preoccupied with a problem in their marriage. And so they're just less present or they're avoidant because that's what they saw from their parents. And so they don't know how to be any different, you know, like there's different reasons, but what I find with, you know, my psychological work with the TMS patients is that a lot of it comes down to these wounds from their attachment experience. Like And that's where I was saying before, I think a mistake that people make when they're trying to do the psychological work is they're looking for these incidents or these like one thing to put it on. And I find it rarely to be that. I usually find it to be some kind of belief system or way of being in the world that's not working from that for them, that kind of stems from this attachment experience. And you know, I know when you interviewed Julie Markowitz, she stressed a lot giving away your power. I would agree with that 100%. You know, I see so much of that in the work that I do, and I wanted to give some of these. I want to give some examples because you know you were talking before about the how and being practical. I want to help people to see like examples of how they're giving up their power or how it's affecting them, so they can plug themselves into it. So one of the things that I wanted to touch on, like what Sarno talked about, the goodist and the perfectionist and rage, like where those things come from. So, you know, if a child or as you're growing up, you're feeling like, if you're not feeling what I am is enough, then you're going to look outside of yourself to know what is enough. So, you know, you can lose yourself because you're become so finely tuned into what do other people think of me? What do they want out of me? What do I do that makes others happy? That's where that, you know, Sarno's goodist comes from. Perfectionism also. Perfectionism is a response to feeling inferior, not feeling enough. So basically a child looks to their parents to know, am I okay? And if they don't get a consistent message that they are, which are those people in these insecure attachment types, then they get stuck there wondering, am I okay? And seeking confirmation that they are. But when they're doing this, and that's the giving away their power, when they're not deciding for themselves and they're letting the world decide for them and they're so tied into that, that's the giving up your power and it creates rage, you know, because everybody's going for what they want and I'm also going for what they want too, you know. And so I find like deep beneath the people that I'm seeing, they're thinking like, you know, what about me? When is it my turn? You know, what about what I want? When do I get to be myself and that be enough? Like they want to stop needing permission and just kind of be. And, you know, a lot of times when I'm sitting with a TMS patient, I'll say to myself, like, they're in pain because they're in pain. Like, what is it that's really hurting them? And I also find that many TMS patients feel like deeply alone, that even if they have people around them, they have family, they have friends, feel very, very deeply alone. And I think, again, it comes down to, you know, this kind of attachment experiences. Because something that comes up a lot in the work that I'm doing with them is I find that TMS patients like are very self-conscious about their humanness. Like they're uncomfortable with having wants and needs. They don't feel entitled to taking up space or when a need comes up, they feel they have to squash it because they're uncomfortable with making it about them. They feel a compulsion to give others what they want, but they negate their own desire. Or a lot of people talk about having feelings as seeing that as being weak. They also have conflicting feelings about wanting things from other people. They want it, but then they judge themselves for wanting it or treat it as if it's not allowed. And this is something also I very, very much see. They deeply crave to be seen. But they do this dance between I want it, I can't have it. I want it, I can't have it. They feel pressure to be independent. And sometimes they come off as fiercely independent or cold, but they actually crave intimacy and like interconnectedness. But it feels like threatening to admit to that.
It kind of seems like the things that, because I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're giving these examples and it's like the way that the people are acting on the outside is exactly a 180 degree of what's going on inside.
Exactly.
It seems like it's to a T. Is that, I haven't read The Divided Mind yet. Is that the concept that Sarno's talking, when he says the divided mind, is that the concept that you're, because it seems like it's a 180 in every single scenario that you're discussing. And if you don't know, that's
question,
okay, by the way.
But it's been many years since I read The Divided Mind, so I don't remember, but I do feel like his later books did focus more on like you know, different physical manifestations. Didn't go that much into the psychology. So I would doubt that it got very psychological. I could be wrong though, because it's been many years since I've read it.
Yeah.
But you know, this is definitely my experience working with, you know, TMS patients, is that there is this real big conflict between how they present and what they really feel on the inside, but they're not conscious that they feel that way on the inside, not usually, or very little. Like, this is what comes out of the work that we do together, is that like what they're saying and how they're acting is not congruent with how they really feel inside.
Do you think that that's almost like a good clue for, maybe this is really simplifying it too much, but this is like a, it's a decent enough clue where how somebody is showing up in the world, basically look at that, how it is that you're showing up in the world, and think exactly the opposite. And that's probably really how you feel unconsciously on the inside. Do you think that that's like, let me give you an example. I was just talking about this with somebody earlier. My wife and I talk about this a lot too. And it's a little, it might seem a little strange, but we have conversations about people that we know in our lives, as an example, that they will talk down on people that are on, that are they're in poverty, or they use food stamps, that they're stealing from the government, and that I'm having to pay for all their mistakes, or people that are anti-universal healthcare and all this. And yet, we would bet with just about every dime that we have that if they fell into really hard times, they would be the first person in line to go and get government assistance. And the same thing applies for people that we've known. This happened. I feel like I've seen stories like this a lot. Somebody is a massive, say, like, they have a lot of homophobic tendencies, or they make really, you know, divisive comments, things like that. But then we find out that they have, like Aaron Hernandez, this documentary just came out about the New England Patriots star that would insult people to the nth degree about anything that would even suggest that they may have feelings for the same sex. And then we find out that he had a homosexual relationship for several, several years.
Oh, wow.
It seems like that's consistent with what you're describing too. Basically how somebody's showing up on the outside, almost like 180 it, and that's kind of what the turmoil that's going on the inside. That's what it's making me think of.
Right, right. And not consciously, you know, but it's like a defense. Like, it feels so, again, getting to that threatening feeling idea, it feels so threatening to feel that way that they're kind of overcompensating for that feeling by living the opposite.
Yep.
You know, and that's why and when I'm doing therapy with a lot of these people, like I really challenge a lot of the things that they bring in, because, you know, is that really true, or is that kind of what they've convinced themselves? And is maybe the opposite true for them? Like, yeah, I think that's a good point.
It's like, I feel like we could now do an hour on Eckhart Tolle. and the whole idea of like the ego, right? Like your egoic attachments and all that stuff.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
I mean, so that's, you know, the basic gist of it, but, you know, in terms of, you know, so, and I'm giving, I hope I'm not like being too information heavy, but the reason why I'm doing that is because, you know, I want to give people the opportunity to see if any of this resonates with them and to plug themselves into this and say, you know, hey, that's me or not, to give you an idea of where the psychological work lies. And, you know, I find, well, two things, I guess, head and heart also. In terms of head, and this might go to, you know, that earlier question you had about the well, let me go journal and everything. I work with people sometimes, and like you said, they may have spent a lot of money on healing so far, doing this program, doing that program. And then they'll come to me and I'll say, well, it sounded like you did that program for like 2 years, but you never really believed it was going to help you. Like, I'm not hearing that you really felt that this was the right course and it was helpful so far and it really resonated. Like, you just kept doing it anyway. What is that about? You know, and a lot of times that's another form of giving away their power, because this person says they're an expert. You just like cling on to whatever they're saying without checking in with yourself. And that's a big part of TMS kind of therapy work, is like cluing them into their gut. Like, what is your gut telling you? Are you validating it? Are you ignoring it? You know, like a lot of times, you know, I know it's very confusing, because you feel like if they're an expert, you should be able to, you know, trust them and listen to them. And the truth is, everybody has success with some people and not success with others. Like, you've got to find that person that has the right message for you. And People spend way too long with the messages not really working with them because, like, well, it's supposed to, so there must be something wrong with me. But a lot of this is just about, like, building an intuition, or what I call a felt sense. I talked about that, you know, when I answered some questions for you in that, I don't remember the episode number, but that's Snowmageddon episode.
You were 100. You were episode 100. How about that?
Oh, right. That I remember because that's an easy number. But when I answered the questions, was a different episode.
Yeah.
I think it was called Snowmageddon. I just don't know the number for it. But there I talk about developing a felt sense. And that's like a really big part of TMS work also, is like knowing how to tune into your gut, use your intuition and honor that more, rather than, you know, treating as the answer is always outside of you. Somebody else knows better than you. And in terms of heart healing, like a lot of, you know, when I've had success with people like that, people who have tried a bunch of other programs and then come to me, a lot of it was like, so basically the healing comes down to, how do I help them to have more of a secure attachment? And I try to be for them what was missing before. And when I model that for them long enough, then they kind of internalize that and then are able to do it for themselves. And what I'm doing that is really helping or healing these people is like, I am really getting to know them. I'm helping them to feel deeply seen and deeply heard and really gotten by me. And that becomes extremely therapeutic and extremely healing, because that's what had been missing all along. And that's what was like the missing piece in the other things that they tried before, was that, it wasn't very individualized. Like, it was skimming over what their needs were. You know, it was more of that incongruence that they may have had in the past. And I'm fixing it by giving that congruence. And by the way, I'm not trying to like toot my own horn or say that I'm the best and you all need to work with me. That's not my agenda. It's more, you know, the opposite. I know that not everybody can work with me and that therapy could be expensive. And I'm just trying to tell people, like, this is what it comes down to, so that you can take that, with you, that it's about this like emotional work of, how do I build more trust in myself? How do I build more trust in the world by healing those wounds of not really being properly tended to? Does that make sense?
It does. And it brings up, you had said doing the emotional work. So one thing that we wanted to do was give a couple of nuggets of things that people can do, you know, the Liz Wallenstein prescription, if you will,
right,
on things to do. You know, earlier we had talked about the pressure that people might feel to journal, as an example, and that if that's just going to put more pressure on the situation, that probably isn't like the best thing for you. So what are some things that people can do?
Right. Again, you know, it's affirming you a lot, meaning like, you know, right now, if that's something that you should do, like, don't journal because everybody tells you it's good to journal for TMS. Like, is that a good thing for you to do in this moment? Does that feel like it would be helpful? Is it something that you want to try? Like, do you hear all that kind of validating of self? I feel like, you know, that's really needed. But I say a lot of the work is in developing that felt sense, like building up intuition. So try to be careful not to just go by your head and use your head, but like check in with your gut. See how something resonates with you. Like, I really like that word, resonate. Some of that body work, like look for sensation within the body and then get curious around that sensation. What information is that part of your body trying to give you? Also self-compassion work, like, you know, TMS patients tend to suffer from, you know, very harsh inner critics and very, you know, rigid standards they hold themselves to. So, can you develop more self-compassion, which is, I was trying to give you some examples of that before in terms of like, if it feels like it would be too much right now to journal, so maybe don't. Like, what would it be? You know, I think of also, I go back to that documentary again, when Michael went to go see, her name just escaped me, the therapist.
Arlene Feinblatt?
Yes, thank you, Arlene Feinblatt. And what's it sounded like what stood out to him was when she said to him, be good to yourself. And like there was something about when she said that to him, it looked like he was able to just kind of relax. And that is the essence of it, is like, you're in pain. You're having a hard time. Like, be good to yourself. And if being good to yourself is not doing the journaling tonight because it feels like too much pressure and you just want to kind of chill, can you give yourself that permission to just chill and trust that the chilling is good for you too and is helpful to you too? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I want to back up for a second because you had mentioned it. Yeah. But I don't think you said somatic work, but that's what you meant, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my more common practices. A lot of times I do it as I'm falling asleep or right when I go to bed. Can you, A, explain what that means, how you would tell somebody to do that? And then two, what has happened? Like, let me give an example. When I do it, it's very much in line with like the Alan Gordon's got a cool video where he goes through and he's doing it for anxiety, you know, basically observe the feeling in your chest, but it can work anywhere. It can work on your knee or your shoulder, or your back or whatever. But I remember I was looking at I wear a heart rate monitor all the time, mostly for exercise and, hey, how hard am I actually working? Am I working as hard as I think I'm working? I'll look at my heart rate, like at the moment where I lay down, what am I thinking about? And then once I start doing that, and then once I fall asleep, and my heart rate will plummet, usually in the mid 40s at that point. And so what is it that's happened? So this is a 2-part thing. So tell us how people do it, how you would advise people to do it. And then two, what is actually happening and why is this helping? Why does it help reduce pain, or why would it reduce tension, or, you know, why is it helping?
Right. So there's a lot of research lately that talks about kind of a second brain that's in your stomach or in your gut. So obviously not literally a brain, but that your body actually holds information too. And I think that TMS patients tend to over rely on their heads at the expense of their body. So you're only getting like a part of the picture. You're not getting the whole picture, and not having the whole picture is hurting you. So when you're doing that body work, you're trying to get the information that's in the body. So, you know, a lot of times I tell people, you know, if your head is overactive, you know, stop and go do something physical, you know, go run around the block if you have to, or do deep breathing, or do some mindfulness technique like tuning into the sensation of the floor beneath your feet, you know, because it takes you out of your head and creates more presence for the body. So those are just some very quick things. But in terms of that somatic work, I tell people to just, you know, close their eyes, get comfortable for a moment, tune into their body, and to just search for a sensation somewhere. And if you're new to this, it's tricky, especially, again, TMS people are very in their heads. But it can be very subtle, and it's not pain. You know, they usually go to their pain first thing. It's not pain. It's just kind of a sensation. So some common ones are like a pit in your stomach, or a fluttering in your chest, or a constriction by your throat, tingling in your fingers. These are some more common ones. So just to search for that sensation. And then when you notice it, get curious around it. So kind of poke around at it and say, like, what's putting you there? What is it that you want me to know? What's your message? And, you know, give it time. Don't rush it to see what's there. And then when it gives you an answer, you know, see if you need to go deeper with it, ask it more questions. Or just sometimes, you know, like when I'm doing that with somebody, they might say, I feel something behind my eyes. I'll say, you know, do you feel like crying? Actually, yes. And, you know, they're very protective of their feelings, TMS patients, so they may not cry in front of me, especially if they're new to me. But I'll say, well, you know, what feels like coming out in your tears? What do you want to cry out? Like, if you were going to, or I'll do imagined conversations. Like, if you could say anything you wanted to your parents, and don't worry, you're not actually going to go do this, but if you could say anything, what would you say? Are you shouting? Are you, you know, and this is all like going a little bit deeper than what they allow into their consciousness. But again, because the body is storing information that the brain is not accessing.
Do you sometimes then dip into that, I forgot the acronym, but that intensive short-term psychodynamic therapy when you say, you know, you're obviously not going to go say this or do this, but what is it that you, because that sounds kind of Schubiner-esque, at least in his book, what he had talked about.
With the intensive short-term?
Yep.
Well, you mean when it gets like really violent, like beating somebody up?
I don't know if you were going there, but that was right. That was what I was thinking of.
I think that that's actually very helpful. I have a little bit hard time with it just because I find like, you know, my clients get very uncomfortable with it. But when I can do it, I will. I might do a little bit of a toned down version of it than some of the things that you'll hear. But yeah, like I'll say like, oh, do you feel like shaking them? Do you feel like slapping them? Do you feel like, you know, kicking them where it hurts? Like go there. Like, tell me, what are you yelling at them as you're doing that? You know, so
I remember when I left my therapist's office for the last time because he was retiring. And at that point, he'd been doing it. He retired at like 74, 75. I think he had been practicing for 45 years or something like that. And I remember as I was leaving, I was just thinking, God, these walls have probably heard some shit in that.
Oh, yeah.
Years. Like,
of course. Because
one of the things that he was in charge of was like the courts in Washington State would if they had like a really bad sexual not sexual abuser or like, for instance, the guy who wrote the original code for Expedia, when they investigated and found that he had like 5,000 hours or something obscene of child pornography on all of his servers or something like that. So he was in charge of the rehabilitation of like the worst of the worst. And I remember just thinking, wow. I was leaving, I was like, this guy, like after 45 years of hearing all this stuff and doing all this stuff, how do you just go wake up next week and, you know, watch whatever, you know, watch cartoons or watch Seinfeld.
Life's
going to
be so boring.
Yeah, life's going to be so boring. Like, totally.
I tell that to people also. If they're afraid to tell me something, I'm like, you're probably not going to tell me anything I haven't heard before.
Right.
Like, I've heard it all, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if, like, I don't know what they're called. So, like, a physician, like a doctor, you know, they go and they do their – this is all my experience on doctors is from watching a lot of ER when I was younger. And
sure.
So, like, Noah –
Dr. Green.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Noah Wiley, whatever his name was.
Right.
Like, Dr. Carter, I think was his name. But he – he'd get out of his residency, and then he's a doctor. So I can only imagine, like, those first 6 months or something when somebody actually starts practicing on their own, the wild – like, they're like, oh, my God, this was, like, the weirdest thing ever that some – you know, I don't know.
Right. But, yeah, and it feels pretty crazy. Like, wow, these people are like, you know, confiding this in me. But, you know, then it goes away and becomes just very normal.
Another note on the somatics. I was I'm in a group chat with these two buddies of mine, and they're 10 years older than me and 13 or 14 years older than me. So I'm the baby of the group. But we will usually first thing in the morning, we send each other a screenshot of our Fitbit sleep scores. And me and my buddy Pete, we had the best scores we'd ever had maybe like 2 weeks ago. So we sent it, and Ken, the oldest of the group, he was like, what did you guys do to get such a good sleep score this time? And Pete says, I took a microdose of CBD. And then he's like, Eddie, what did you do? I said, I did a microdose of somatic tracking. I don't think they found it funny, but
right. I like it.
Yeah, right. Psychology
I like
joke.
That answer.
Yeah, therapy joke.
Right. Right.
You know, we're rounding out at an hour six here. So I guess we have a couple choices. Are there additional items on the heart side that you want to tackle? Do you want to tackle some of the questions? How do you want to round out?
I mean, obviously, you know, I could go on and on for hours, but I just tried to give you like the basic gist. And you know, like I say at the end of a session, usually, well, now, you know, I say most of the work happens between sessions. Like, now see that I've given you this information or we've talked about this, you know, how does it resonate? What does it bring up for you?
Yes.
You know, what do you relate to? And, you know, for those who journal, they can journal on that. But, you know, I just really wanted to, I personally haven't heard people talk about, you know, attachment theory and how it might connect to this TMS stuff. So I encourage people just to think about, like, and I can give you some resources also for books on this, but to think about like what's their attachment style and, you know, how do they think that that's affected their psychological development? And that question of like, you know, I said, when somebody sits down with me, I say, okay, you're hurting because you're hurting. Like, what is hurting this person? And not just to focus on like the obvious stuff or the stressors, like, oh, work is hard right now. And, you know, more of just like what feels threatening if I was to confront it, like what's like a core pain of mine, or how might I be like uncomfortable with my humanness, with having, you know, being a person with needs and wants. And I think if you focus your emotional work in those areas, You can make a lot of progress in terms of the emotional work for TMS.
And you're saying that a lot of that could be derived off which category of the four do you more fall into?
Yeah, you know, start from there. Like, identify it. If you want, like I said, I could tell you more information to read up about it. And then, you know, whatever, journal all about it, think about it. But just think about, like, what was that like for me? You know, somebody's making me see that my parents wasn't totally congruent with my needs. I didn't feel totally gotten. And, like, what does that bring up for me? Cry it out if you have to. Get angry about it if you have to. You know, try to have some visceral reactions. Like, I'll tell people, you know, scream in the shower, or, you know, have a good cry, or, like, shake your fists as you're thinking about it. Like, try to work it through your body. That's another practical tip. You know, the emotion that you're identifying. Like, the big thing is, don't just keep it in your brain. You know, you want to work it. I always say digest it. You want to work it through your body by actually, you know, experiencing that emotion that you're realizing is there.
What I would say, yes. Tell us a couple resources that, and I'm going to actually type them in while I'm here so I can remember to put them in the notes, in the show notes. But what are a couple of resources or further reading that you were alluding to?
Okay. So, there's a bunch of books about attachment out there. Like I said, a lot of times the people use it for understanding relationship dynamics, but I find it really helpful even just for this stuff. So I'll give you a few different based on where people are in their lives. So there's one that's meant for parents. But I've even recommended it to people who aren't parents, because I think it just has good information to understand it and be able to see yourself in it. It's by Daniel Siegel, Dr. Dan Siegel. Trying to think of the name.
Hold on. I'm bringing up Dr. Dan Siegel books. Is it the Whole Brain Child Workbook?
No, he has a bunch of books. Parenting from the Inside Out. Is that it?
If it's in there, I have. Oh, yep. It's How a Deeper Self-Understanding Can Help You Raise Children Who Thrive. That one.
Right. But the title is Parenting
from the Inside Out. Yeah.
Right. So that's a great book for understanding attachment theory, and especially if you're interested in how it applies now to raising your kids. But even without that piece, and even if you don't have kids, it's just a good way of being able to find yourself in it and think about how it impacted you. Another author, I can't pick a book in specific, but he's got a bunch of books about this and how it applies to marriage and relationships, is his name is Stan Tatkin, T-A-T-K-I-N. So he has a bunch of books about attachment theory, and he focuses a lot on how it shows up in marriages.
Wired for Love, then, Wired for Dating, Your Brain on
yes,
Love.
Yeah, yes, kind of yes, thank you. The Wired books, yes. And then there's a book called Attached, The Science of Something by Amir Levine, A-M-I-R-L-E-V-I-N-E. You pull that one up?
The New Science of Adult Attachment. Yeah, Attached.
Right. So that one I recommend to single people a lot, but also I really liked that one a lot. It has very good – that actually has like exercises in it, like test questions you can answer to see what your attachment style is. It's also good for married people, or, you know, attached or whatever, excuse the pun, but, you know, that also I really liked a lot, especially for anxious attachment people. I think that has a lot of good information in it. And it's a very easy read. So those are like three authors and, you know, books that I would recommend for, if you want more information about this.
I do get asked from time to time, I forgot how they word it. Usually it's like, what are good non-TMS TMS books, or what are good TMS non-TMS books? You know what I mean?
Right.
Where they can sort of like derive some information to help them in what it is that they're doing right now. That's not a, I mean, the thing is, I think there's a very large, there's a like sort of one sole genre of TMS books that are out there. And when Dan Ratner was here a couple weeks ago, one thing that he said is the book he's writing, which his editor has said, you have to get to under 400 pages. And he's at 800 in his first draft. His book is entirely on doubt, like doubting the TMS diagnosis.
Wow.
And why does that exist? Because he says like, there's a bazillion books out there, but they're sort of all written very similarly.
Right. So. Yeah, I agree. There's not enough from the psychological perspective, I think, also.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, you know, I feel like people tend to pit one person against the other, like who's right and who's wrong. And it's not about that. I made a comment before. It's like, what resonates with you?
Yep.
Like, what do you connect best with? Because they're all good and they're all useful. It's just like, don't overcommit yourself to one. Like, check in with yourself. Like, does this speak to me? Do I relate to this? Is this helping me? And if it is, great, keep going with it. And if it's not, try somebody else. Like, there's enough people out there doing different things and they're all right and they're all good.
I mean, it's really no different. Like this podcast as an example, usually I'll go and I'll read iTunes and some people may say like, this is the greatest podcast that has ever existed on chronic pain. And then I'll come across one on like TMS Wiki where this guy says, this is the worst podcast I've ever listened to. So,
right.
So it's like, you know, each to their own, right?
Right. You can never please everybody. Everybody's got a different, you know, cup of tea and they're all in different places. And, you know, it's just what works for you.
Right.
But I was pretty impressed by your reach. I mean, I didn't realize how many people listen to this.
It's hard to believe for me too. I remember in the beginning, the first few months, I would like look at a word because there would be like a place I had never heard of. Like, what was it called? The Faroe Islands. There was something. There was a couple places where,
wow,
I was like, I've never even heard of this. And I would look at it on a map and I go, how does somebody in the Maldives find this? You know what I mean?
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
good
but,
for you.
Yeah, but they do. I haven't spent a dollar on marketing though. How about that?
That's really amazing.
But I mean, you know, by the time this airs, it'll be 112 or 113 episodes. So it's, you know, a lot of work for that reach. So,
right. For sure.
Yes. Liz, thank you so much. I have a sneaking suspicion that a part three will be warranted at some point.
Yeah. I feel badly that we didn't get to any of the questions. I was really, really hoping we would, but my thinking was that if I could, you like give some of this information that session after session has shown to be like very useful for people, then hopefully even if it's indirectly, it will answer the most questions for the most people and be able to help the most people. But if anybody still has any like burning questions they feel like I didn't address and they would like me to address it, you know, I encourage them to, if they, you know, I don't know if you want to say they can send it to you or if they want to send it to me through my website and, you know, we could do a part three or I could, you know, again, just kind of record some short answer questions for you. Like, I'm happy to do that.
Where, I know I mentioned at the very top of the show, but where can people find you?
So I recently, we talked about this before, but I recently relocated from New York to Phoenix, Arizona. So I have a practice in Arizona, but right now my practice is mostly online. I'm seeing people all throughout the U.S.,
That I was going to say that New York accent is deep and thick. I don't know if
you're
I don't know if you're ever going to get whatever a Phoenix accent is. I don't know if it's ever coming.
I don't know what it is either, but no, I think this is too deep. it's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Liz, thank you so much for your time again.
Thank you. This is great.